You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the dreaming.
I'm going to talk about something a bit different now. I'm going to have a bit of a quick yarn about AI data centres. You know, it's something that is a very hot topic at the moment, and for good reason. You know, there's a whole bunch of reasons why people are discussing this, in particular why they're discussing it in a very critical way. Now, you know, first and foremost, there is a whole bunch of health and environmental impacts around data centers. You know, this is something that we already know to be true. Now, you know, there's the massive water usage. For example, data centers use a massive amount of water, and in particular, they need fresh water, you know, fresh potable water that is, you know, free of pollutants and chemicals and silt and whatever else. So, you know, they're taking all of this drinking water and they're using it to cool these systems. And as a result, it's having a major impact on the freshwater supplies in areas where data centers have been set up, in particular these newer AI data centers. Now, there's also, you know, all the other stuff that goes with that, whether it be land clearing, whether it be all of the rare earth minerals that they use to build these data centers, rare earth minerals that, of course, are stripped from the land in places like so-called Australia, of course, where First Nations people are dispossessed of that land, you know, where sacred sites are blown up and ecosystems are destroyed so they can get out these rare earth minerals, but also in places like across Africa, where we're seeing a whole lot of major issues connected with extraction, in particular the extraction being undertaken by Western mining companies or Western-backed interests. You know, there's quite a lot of murder and slaughter and displacement and genocide at the end of the day that is happening in various places across Africa to get at these rare earth minerals that are needed to build stuff like these AI data centers. Now, the other, you know, one of the other main issues for these AI data centers is what they're actually being built for. Now, for the most part, quite a lot of these AI data centers are linked to surveillance programs. You know, they're linked to all of these different companies that are using AI to surveil the population, as well as to build up databases on the population, you know, and how the population reacts to certain things, you know, how they move, how they interact with each other and interact with different events and et cetera, et cetera. Now, all of this surveillance is, of course, only ever going to be used to further repress the working class. You know, we know that surveillance programs like this from capitalist colonial governments don't exist to serve the people. They don't exist for public safety. They exist to keep the working class in line. Now, there is a bunch of other health stuff that is connected to data centers that is still, as of yet, unconfirmed. So, you know, maybe I won't go into that so much. But I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what are we meant to do about all of these data centers that are being set up? You know, what do we do about it at the end of the day? Because, you know, at the end of the day, we've got to be a bit realistic with ourselves, and we've got to, you know, really assess the material conditions here around these data centers being built. You know, assess stuff like the interests and the players that exist within the community that have an ability to actually challenge these data centers being constructed. You know, so when we're thinking about this, you know, first and foremost, we have to acknowledge the fact that these companies that are building these new data centers, you know, they already have the plan to do it. You know, they've got the capital, they've got the political backing of the elected politicians to be able to build these data centers. You know, for all intents and purposes, you know, they consider the construction of these data centers to be an inevitable outcome for themselves. You know, at the end of the day, they're not thinking, can we build a data center here? They're thinking, we're going to build a data center. You know, that's the way it is. You know, so in regards to that, I think that there is actually a very limited potential in being able to mobilize the local community to push back against data centers being built in your local area. You know, that being said, nevertheless, I still think that there is some potential for it to happen. You know, whether that be through stuff like political pressure, whether it be through petitions, you know, courts, whether it be through protests or, you know, whatever combination works for that community. But at the end of the day, we have to remember, you know, as I was just saying, that construction is, for the most part, it's quite inevitable. You know, if it's not going to be built in a community because that community manages to place the pressure on the company to build it elsewhere, that's exactly what they'll do. They'll just go build it elsewhere. They'll move it on to the next community. Or if they're getting a lot of pushback, they'll find somewhere that's a bit more discreet. You know, somewhere that's a bit less populated, somewhere that's a bit more out of the way. And the ironic thing about that is, you know, that latter option for where they might build the data center could actually potentially mean a far greater ecological impact than building one in a more densely populated area. Because, you know, when you think about it, the more densely populated area, the ecology is already quite degraded. You know, the area is already being cleared, the native fauna and flora have already been displaced. But if you go build a data center that's out of the way, away from people, odds are it's going to have a lot more ecological value. There's going to be a lot more remnant populations of fauna and flora there. So actually moving them out of these densely populated areas, you know, sure, we might take the burden of having an AI data center off the local community, but we're just putting that burden back onto the natural world when we do so. There's some other issues around, you know, trying to oppose these data centers as well, you know, in terms of the actual material potential to be able to do so. You know, Australia is a very small country and we have an even smaller left-wing movement on this continent. And within that movement, there's an even smaller, tiny little minority faction who, you know, for better or worse, I'm not condoning or condemning this sort of actions, but you know, who might try and physically oppose a data center being built. You know, at the end of the day, though, we don't have the labor capacity and resources to be able to do that on this continent. Not in any long-term sense anyways, when you've got data centers popping up all over the shop. You know, along those lines as well, you know, the third thing is I don't believe that we actually have enough, a large enough and a potent enough movement here on this continent to actually, you know, do some sort of mass protest against data centers on the street. You know, don't get me wrong though, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But let's be realistic, even if we could mobilize 1 million people to get out on the street to march against data centers, you know, I don't think that would actually compel the government to do much. You know, it certainly wouldn't if we consider that millions of people marching on the street against the Iraq war achieved nothing. You know, it didn't stop Australia's involvement in the Iraq war. You know, not when we consider in the modern time even, you know, several years now of marching most weeks for Palestine, and there's been millions of people on the street as a result of that, but yet the Australian colonial government continues to provide its support to Israel and what Israel is doing in Palestine. So, you know, I don't place much faith and hope and emphasis on mass marches against things. You know, at the end of the day, sure, they might highlight the issue and, you know, they might get the issue in the mainstream media even, but I don't know to what extent it actually challenges that issue. Now, you know, when we consider all of these things, I actually think that, you know, the only way to really challenge these data centers, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot and, you know, I know this might sound a bit more of a reformist approach, and I'm somebody who often speaks out against reformist kind of approaches, but, you know, I think that the only way is to take that more reformist approach is to try and, you know, work with the elected politicians to pass legislation that will, at the very least, make it harder to set up these data centers, if not stop them altogether. You know, it's to do stuff like, you know, launch court cases, for example. You know, maybe there's some sort of like public interest or similar sort of public health interest that could justify a court case, you know, being launched. You know, I think that's maybe the only way forward to, you know, really try and use the system in such a way where the system itself can be weaponized against the construction of these AI data centers. Because, you know, at the end of the day, like, we've got to be realistic. You know, we don't live in some happy ending movie. You know, there's no bunch of ragtag misfits who are coming to save the day. You know, the capitalists who are building these data centers, they do not care about the climate or the ecological or health impacts of data centers. And, you know, in fact, realistically, you know, they're actually relying on it a bit. They're relying on it because they know that they're going to profit off it. They know that they're going to profit off of health crises and ecological and climate collapse. You know, there's no real sort of revolutionary movement on this continent that could actually challenge these data centers. You know, the best bet is, you know, sad as it is literally try and use those very systems that are bringing the data that centers here in the first place. Try and use those systems against it. You know, I think in this regard, reformism is one of the only ways forward on this continent. And, you know, it's purely because of the material conditions here. It's purely because at the end of the day, you know, so much of the so-called movement on this continent belongs to the labor aristocracy on a global level. You know, that is to say that so much of the working class here benefits so much from the Western Empire and imperialism and capitalism that I don't see them effectively challenging it. Sad state of affairs, but, you know, it is what it is, I suppose.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Just before the last song, I was talking a bit about AI data centers and, you know, what I see as the potential ways to combat their construction here in so-called Australia. Now, I wanted to talk just real briefly a bit more on why, you know, that's such an important thing for us to be doing. Australia, ecologically speaking, Australia is quite a unique and wonderful and beautiful place. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people actually truly realize exactly how unique and amazing and magical this continent is. So I'm just going to spit some quick facts at you just to give you a bit of an idea. You know, Australia is home to the most species of reptiles in the world. We've got more reptile species here in this country than any other country in the world can lay claim to. You know, when we look at stuff like birds, we've got an amazing wealth of unique stats and figures here. So for example, the east coast of Australia, together with the west coast of New Zealand and the ocean in between Australia and New Zealand, is home to the densest variety of marine bird species, you know, for example. And, you know, when we look at birds again, it was actually the Daintree rainforest up in Queensland where songbirds first evolved. So, you know, all of the songbirds that exist in the world, that, you know, particular family of birds known as the songbirds, they can all trace their lineage back to the Daintree rainforest. You know, again, when we're looking at the Daintree is the oldest rainforest in the entire world. You know, it's much older than the Amazon. It's older than, you know, any other rainforest anywhere else. It's been here for millions and millions of years. It coexisted with the dinosaurs. That's how old it is. So, you know, of course, it's no surprise that stuff like songbirds evolved in the Daintree. Now, speaking of the Daintree and speaking of, you know, Queensland and the northern half of the continent, if you look at the Sahul Shelf, which is the continental shelf that Australia, West Papua, Papua New Guinea, and a few other islands sit on, you know, that continent was above sea level, you know, 10 to 20,000 years ago. And what I mean by that is West Papua and Papua New Guinea were actually connected to the top of Australia via a land bridge. Now, that area, you know, West Papua, Papua New Guinea, and the northern part of Australia has the highest density of amphibian species in the world. You know, everyone talks about all the frogs in the Amazon, but we've got even more species of frogs and toads and, you know, other amphibians that are in that northern half of the Sahul continent. So, you know, again, that's something very unique. And, you know, in fact, when we look at the whole entire east coast of Australia, the east coast of Australia, in particular New South Wales and Queensland, from around the Jervis Bay area up to around the top of the Great Barrier Reef. That's the highest marine biodiversity in the entire world. And in fact, you can split that in half. You can look at the central and south coast of New South Wales, and you can look at the Great Barrier Reef as two separate locations. And there's your number one and number two for world's highest marine biodiversity. You know, those two places individually take out the prize, let alone when we combine them. And, you know, stuff like mammals. You know, one of the only places in the world with mammals, the only place you, only other place you'll find mammals is, you know, one or two species over in the Americas. Those are possums and whatever else they have over there. But we've got all of these amazing marsupials here. And again, you know, something really amazing and unique about them is how old they are. You know, they give birth to such primitive young because they were some of the first mammal species to evolve. And in fact, when we look at stuff like the platypus is the oldest surviving mammal species in the entire world. Another little cool fact about platypuses is the males actually have a venomous spur, you know, a little venomous spur that they can defend themselves with. Only venomous mammal in the world. You know, that's how far back their lineage goes. Their lineage goes right back to a time when most mammals are actually venomous, you know, small little creatures that use venom to defend themselves from dinosaurs and whatever else. And, you know, going back to birds again, oldest surviving bird species on the planet right now is the cassowary up in Queensland. You know, there's so many other things I could list off too. I could go on about this all day about the unique state of wildlife here. And it's not just animals, it's plants as well. Now, we've got the most carnivorous plants in the world, for example, here in so-called Australia. You know, something like nearly half of the species or something like that resides on this continent alone. And, you know, we've got all of these other really amazing old plant species that go back to, some of them even older than the dinosaurs. You know, go back hundreds of millions of years, some of these lineages of these different plants. And, you know, the only place you'll find them, in fact, the only place you'll find their genus and their family is here on this continent. You know, there's so much unique wildlife, fauna and flora, that we're absolutely destroying, especially when we consider that today Australia's got one of, if not the highest deforestation rate in the world and the highest extinction rate in the world and, you know, all of these other horrific rates that are one of, if not the highest in the world. And then we're going to go chuck data centers into the mix as well, which is just going to increase that ecological and climate destruction that is happening. You know, so it's something that really needs to be pushed back against, in my opinion. And not enough people are, you know, getting involved. Not enough people are involved in organizing. Not enough people are, you know, involved in activism and whatever else. And there's not enough people out there that are doing their role to protect the environment either. You know, it's something that is all of our responsibility at the end of the day. You know, I think if you're a human and if you rely on fresh air and clean water and safe food, then you rely on a safe climate and you rely on a safe environment and a safe ecosystem. You know, if you rely on those things, you have a responsibility to make sure that they're looked after. You have a responsibility to yourself, to your family, to your community, your kids and your grandkids and your neighbors and everybody else in the mix. So, you know, get out there and do something about it. Get out there and plant some local native plants. You know, get out there and rip your lawn up and get rid of all the invasive species in your gardens and replace them with actual native indigenous species that help to bolster that local biodiversity, you know, help to feed our native pollinators and our native birds and, you know, provide them with habitat and refuge and whatever else. Now get out there and do something. There's something that all of us can do. You know, it doesn't matter how much time or how much cash or resources or whatever you have. There is something you can do to get involved and to help out. So get out there and do it.
Become a 3CR subscriber today. Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377. Be a part of your community radio station.
Just before those songs, I was talking a bit about AI and, you know, the environmental and ecological and climate impacts that AI can potentially have and that it is already having. As well as, you know, the uniqueness of the Australian ecosystem and, you know, why that is something that needs to be protected. You know, something else I just quickly add on to that is that we've got so many unique ecosystems here as well that are just not present anywhere else on the planet. You know, a really great example of that is out on Gugufa country, out on Aunty Sue Hasseldine's country, who we've had on this show a number of times in the past. But out there on Gugufa country, where she's fighting against Southern Launch and their rocket testing, they have what is known as a stunted mallee forest. Now, this stunted mallee forest is the only one of its type in the world. You know, once they destroy that, if they end up destroying that through their, you know, rocket testings and all the other stuff they're doing out there, once that's gone, like, that's it. That's gone for good. You know, there's no more of them left anywhere on the earth. You know, so something that we really need to fight and work to protect. And another thing I just like to really factor into all of these conversations is just how much of an impact we actually are having. Now, you know, when you think about the plants and animals that have gone extinct over the last 100 or so years, you know, many of those species have been around for an incredible long time. You know, some of them even, you know, especially some of the marine species and some of the, you know, invertebrates and whatever else, you know, some of these species have actually been around for hundreds of millions of years. You know, there's an example I read recently. I've forgotten the name. I think it's maybe like a hognose fish or something like that. But there's some sort of fish that recently went extinct in China. Now, this fish has been around for hundreds of millions of years. It coexisted with the dinosaurs and it survived the, you know, great extinction event that wiped out the dinosaurs. But then humans come along and within 50 years of development in the area, that species is gone. Now, you know, this is just one of probably countless species of plants and animals that have a similar story. You know, plants and animals that have been around for so long, that have survived so many different extinction events. You know, they've survived ice ages and they've survived global warmings and they've survived meteor impacts and, you know, all of these other really catastrophic events that have wiped out, you know, maybe 90% plus of all life species at the time. And they can survive all of these really chaotic and hectic things, but then humans come along and they can't survive that. You know, that in itself should tell you all you need to know about the impact that we're having. We're having a greater impact than a massive meteorite slamming into the earth and wiping out all of these different species. Now, going back to AI though, you know, another really horrible thing that AI is doing is having a massive cultural impact. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, I often get on here and I often criticize Western culture or lack thereof, you know, lack thereof, the settler culture and whatever else, but, you know, putting all that stuff to one side for the time being, you know, AI is having quite a massive impact on, you know, culture and on education and on general intelligence within society. But in particular, when we're looking at the cultural impacts, there's so much to unpack here, so I'll try and do it as concisely and summarize it as best as I can. But you've got AI having all of these big impacts on stuff like art, on stuff like literature, and the kind of impacts that they're having are obviously, you know, first and foremost, the impacts that you might be aware of, stuff like the plagiarism and, you know, the way that they're essentially creating platforms where people can generate AI slop, you know, absolute slop of artwork and songs and whatever else and stuff, but they can do it with just a prompt or two and then they can put that out. You know, it's having that sort of impact, don't get me wrong. But the more bigger kind of impacts I wanted to talk about is the way that it's actually destroying a lot of the cultural heritage within the world. Now, one really great example of this is how a lot of AI firms at the moment are buying up a lot of really rare old books. And they're destroying these books so that they can scan them. Now, the way that they do it, you know, they get these really old books and they cut the spine off the book so that they can put the pages through these, you know, rapid scanners that will scan all the pages, you know, in quick succession or whatever. But they're destroying the book in order to be able to do that. Now, you know, I'm not just talking about books that have, you know, I'm not talking about like Harry Potter, for example, that's got millions and millions of copies that have been made. Like, who cares if an AI firm wants to destroy, you know, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, you know, whoop-de-doo, there's probably tens of millions of them out there. I'm talking about books that there might only be one or two or, you know, maybe three copies left in the entire world. And, you know, books that go back to maybe the 1800s, maybe even earlier. And they're getting these books and they're destroying them so they can scan it into their systems. And as a result, you know, now they're the only source of being able to view the pages of this book. You know, you've got to go sign up and subscribe and, you know, do all this other stuff to be able to access what should be public knowledge at the end of the day. You know, I'm a big believer in education and knowledge being publicly accessible. But, you know, they're doing stuff like this. And, you know, if you're not a big book nerd, you know, it might not sound like a big thing. Like, you know, oh, they're just destroying a book or two. You know, what's it really matter? You know, I'd like to put it to people a different way. You know, imagine if somebody, some private collector, was to go and buy the Mona Lisa or to go and buy the roof of the Sistine Chapel or, you know, go and buy one of these other great artworks that are world-renowned, and they were to scan it and then destroy it, you know, so that they had a digital copy of this artwork. But then that's it, like the real hard copy is gone, doesn't exist anymore. You know, imagine if somebody was to go and get, you know, I remember when the Notre Dame Cathedral caught fire a few years ago, or the billions of dollars that were raised in only a few days to be able to repair that. Now imagine if one of these private collectors was to go and buy the Notre Dame Cathedral and, you know, scan its blueprint into their system and then in the process bulldoze the entire Notre Dame Cathedral. Now imagine if they were to go and do this to some other, you know, cultural relic or artifact, or, you know, some other sort of site of heritage significance. You know, a lot of people would rightfully think, you know, that's not okay. But yet, they're doing this with all of these books. And, you know, it's just one of the many ways that AI is also starting to pervert stuff like culture and cultural expression and, you know, language and intelligence and knowledge and stuff like that. You know, so there's so many reasons to be against these sort of things. You know, I don't know anybody who, in their right mind, would think that these are good things to be happening, or, you know, think that this is something that can be defended. We've got about 15 minutes left on the show. Don't go anywhere. But coming up next, we've got DJ Curly taking you through to 2 o'clock with Cultural Kinetics, playing some great uplifting beats. It's really great that this slot comes after mine, because, you know, I often talk about quite sad and depressing and doom and gloom things on my show. It's good for Curly to come on and lift the mood back up again. But speaking of which, you know, something else I just wanted to touch on while we're talking about ecological destruction, you know, something that is being discussed quite a lot in the mainstream media and, you know, in online discourses and whatever at the moment, is horse coals. You know, the culling of brumbies in places like the Kosciuszko National Park. Now, you know, for various different reasons, there's quite a lot of people in society who oppose horse coals. And, you know, I just wanted to, I suppose, touch on that a bit for a moment. You know, because a lot of the reasons why people oppose horse coals, you know, it doesn't actually make logical sense, and they're just, you know, playing whataboutisms and, you know, distracting from the issues at hand. Now, at the end of the day, though, we do know that invasive, you know, feral introduced pests, stuff like horses, deers, you know, boars, foxes, and cats and rabbits, have such an, you know, such a dramatic and drastic impact on our local ecosystems and local ecology. Now, you know, something I just really wanted to touch on here is that, you know, quite often a lot of people, you know, as a excuse to save the horses or not to call the horses, you know, they bring up whataboutisms, like, you know, what about the Snowy Hydro Project, for example, and the fact that this is also, you know, a major ecological risk to the Kosciuszko National Park and, you know, Snowy River and whatever else. And, you know, don't get me wrong, they're correct. You know, at the end of the day, those things are risks, you know, they're things that we should be opposing as well. You know, it's not a either or. It's not a case of you either support horse coals or you, you know, support blocking the ecological destruction that development does. You know, you can do both. But something I really wanted to touch on here is the fact that they're actually very false equivalents. You know, at the end of the day, if we look at the impact that are done by four primary species, you know, those species being horses, pigs, not even pigs, you know, being horses, foxes, cats and rabbits, Now, if we look at those four species and we look at the amount of native species that they put at risk of extinction, they're actually worse than pretty much anything else that's happening right now. In fact, if we combine the risk to the ecosystem and to species extinction that logging, land clearing, and development combined has, and we compare that to the risk that horses, cats, foxes, and rabbits combined have, the conservative estimates actually tell us that those feral pests are 50 times worse. And they're the conservative estimates. You know, if we look at the upper range of the estimates, those four pest species are actually up to 100 times worse. So, you know, anywhere from at least 50 times worse to 100 times worse. So for every native animal that is going extinct as a result of something like the Snowy Hydro Project, or, you know, logging or land clearing or, you know, developing, whatever it may be, for every one animal that goes extinct there's between 50 and 100 animals that are at risk of going extinct as a result of these introduced pests. So, you know, they really are such a dramatic impact on the ecosystem. And, you know, ironically, in many ways, the herbivores are actually worse than the carnivores. You know, don't get me wrong, cats, for example, feral and roaming cats have an absolutely devastating impact on our native wildlife. They kill something like 2 billion native vertebrates every year. You know, and by that I mean, by vertebrates, I mean, you know, your mammals, your birds, your reptiles, and your amphibians. You know, I'm not even talking about insects and stuff like that. I'm just talking about those bigger life forms with a spine in their back. 2 billion a year feral and native roaming cats kill in Australia. But rabbits kill several times more. Rabbits are actually something like 4 or 5 times more of a threat to native wildlife than cats are. And, you know, likewise horses, and, you know, horses, it's a bit weird when we look at horses and we compare them to stuff like cats and foxes. Horses aren't as distributed across the continent as a rabbit or a cat or a fox is. You know, you can essentially find rabbits, cats, and foxes right across the continent in pretty much every ecosystem and, you know, every local region. Horses, however, can only be found in a few places. So, you know, they don't have that same spread. But where horses can be found, though, they actually have a more acute impact. You know, that is to say that the horses are more destructive in the areas that they are than a rabbit is over, you know, the broader area of the continent. So, you know, when we look at places like Kosciuszko, for example, again, looking at these unique ecosystems of the world, you know, horses are actually a very massive threat for that ecosystem. There's a lot of, for example, frogs up there that, you know, you won't find anywhere else in the world. They only exist in, you know, a handful of waterways up in the Kosciuszko National Park. Likewise, we've got a bunch of stuff like Galaxia, which is a genus or a family of native fish. You know, there's a lot of Galaxia that only exist in a handful or less waterways up in the Kosciuszko. And, you know, the horses absolutely destroy these waterways. They come in and they trash the bank. They increase the turbidity of the water and pollutants in the water. You know, they do stuff like they compact all the soil, meaning that our native plants can't germinate in that soil. And, you know, the already established plants die because they get suffocated from the compacted soil. Not only that, it traps stuff like nutrients into pockets. And, you know, it makes it inhospitable for the plants. And, you know, you've got all these other animals up there, like skinks, for example. There's a bunch of native skinks up there that, you know, again, probably the only place in the world you'll find these sorts of animals. And then you've got these big, massive, you know, several hundred kilo hard hoof creatures coming through and just absolutely trashing the place, destroying the place. And the thing is, too, like, the ironic thing is a lot of people talk about how cruel culling is. It's actually one of the most it's one of the most humane ways to deal with them. You know, some of the other alternatives that people put forward are stuff like, why don't we just, you know, sterilize and make them infertile so that they can't breed and they'll just die off naturally. You know, that's all well and good. You know, we might be preventing a future generation, but in the meantime, those adults are going to continue to trash the place and destroy the place. Not only that, you know, do you know how cruel that would be for that horse to capture that horse, you know, a wild animal, to capture it and put it through all that stress and then to, you know, undertake medical procedures on it. And that's going to cause a lot of stress for that animal as well. You know, likewise, people talk about, oh, we can round them up and send them to farms. Again, these are wild animals. You know, they're not domesticated horses. They're not jumping in the back of a horse float willingly. You've essentially got to, you know, stress and pressure and drive these creatures into these horse floats. In the meantime, you know, it just causes, you know, injuries to these animals. It causes stress to these animals. It causes, you know, all of these other issues. And it's only a tiny minority that is actually successfully go through those programs. So, you know, for every like 1 in 100 horses you're saving, you're probably traumatizing and tormenting and torturing and leading to the death of, you know, however many more horses as well. So, you know, there's a lot of different factors here. You know, at the end of the day, maybe a quick shot to the head is actually the most humane way to deal with this. You know, and a lot of people don't like that and they don't like to hear that. But at the end of the day as well, you know, it's a responsibility we all have to take. It's not about whether or not you like animals to die. You know, obviously any right-minded person does not enjoy the death of other animals. But it's not about enjoying that death. It's about enjoying the outcome, which is having an intact ecosystem. You know, it's about preserving those ecosystems and preventing their destruction. And, you know, preventing the destruction of the extinction, sorry, I should say, of all those animals as well. Because, you know, at the end of the day, a horse isn't endangered. You know, horses are on every single continent that humans are on. You know, they're not at any risk of going endangered or extinct, so they don't belong here. You know, we need to sort this issue. And at the end of the day, it is a man-made issue. So man has to clean that up. Man has to address that issue. You know, this whole kumbaya approach of, oh, well, they're here now, like, it'll just be cruel to get rid of them. You know, that doesn't solve the problem. You know, that doesn't address anything. That is just a weak excuse to get out of having to clean up a mess that you have created at the end of the day. So yeah, we got about 5-6 minutes left on the show. I'm going to go to another song. That'll be it from me for today. I'll be back again next week from 11 to 1. You're listening to Yilliman on 3CR, 855M in your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online and available via the playback service. I'm Kieran and I'll be back again next week. Until then, have a good one.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.